Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
To my successor, whoever he or she may be. Number one, stay close to the Americans. Stick up for the Ukrainians. Stick up for freedom.
I helped get this country through an incredibly difficult period over the last couple of years. I made sure that we supported those who needed our help at every step.
What I believe is that lowering taxes, opening up opportunities, is going to help us deliver the economic growth that Britain needs.
You're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And good afternoon, I'm Caroline Hepke.
Well, Parliament is no longer sitting. MPs start their summer recess from today, but it doesn't look like politics is going to take a break over the next few weeks.
Well, on today's programme, Ben Zaranko from the Institute for Fiscal Studies joins us to explore the next Prime Minister's tax plans. No doubt that will be in focus over the summer. And we also speak to Peter Oborne about truth in politics and his book, The Assault on Truth, Boris Johnson, Donald Trump and the Emergence of a New Moral Barbarism.
But first,
this is so awkward.
Where's Boris Johnson?
Oh wait, are we on telly?
Yeah.
Boris is back at number 10 Downing Street.
Have they all kicked him out yet? Why are they all kicking him out?
He's got a big
I still think Larry should be the Prime Minister.
Well, that was Liz Truss finding out the hard way that meeting members of the public doesn't always go as planned. Now, Caroline, do you reckon that kids ask harder questions than adults?
I mean, on that evidence, of course. I love it. Those boisterous kids giving politicians a hard time. Yes, I think, A, it depends on... It's about age appropriateness, isn't it? How you answer those questions. But they're always going to put you on the spot. You know, they ask you why the sun shines and the tides flow. But that, I love that little boy, yeah.
Yeah, I would think any politicians, particularly in a leadership race, don't go meet kids. I think would be the takeaway from that. Now, Liz Truss isn't the only one to be caught out by children. Do you remember this excruciating moment for Rishi Sunak?
Do you prefer Coke or Pepsi?
Do you ask everyone this question? Or not? No, I'm only really funny because I'm a massive... So one of these things that not that many people know about me. So I collect Coca-Cola things.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, I'm a Coke addict. Total Coke addict.
Total Coke addict. Yeah, probably... Not
not the right phrasing, I think, for that. But no, you could see that Sunak was kind of squirming commercially. He didn't want to back one horse or the other, did he?
Yeah, so awkward. Now, there's a serious point to all of this, and that is the Conservative leadership race. And we have that YouGov poll out, which gives Liz Truss a pretty healthy lead, a whopping 24 points ahead of Rishi Sunak amongst them. They think it surveyed about 700 Conservative Party members. It's not the first poll we've had. But it looks like a pretty solid lead for Truss at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they obviously are both looking for their messages to go down smoothly with Conservative Party voters. Now, I think this is pretty fascinating. Men, women and Leave voters apparently all prefer Rishi Sunak.
Yeah, interesting that. It's kind of slightly concerning for Sunak that only Remainers are the only key group we seem to be backing, which is a bit of troublesome in the Conservative Party at the moment. But interesting that so Tory voters are so keen on those tax cuts that Truss is promising. And Sunak's competence message doesn't seem to be going down that well. Another very interesting thing is that the ballots go out on the 1st of August. So that is only 9 days away. And although Tory members have until September to vote, the received wisdom is that once the ballots are out, people think, oh, well, I may as well fill that in. So they send it off straight away. So what happens in this next week to 10 days? Absolutely crucial.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, whoever wins, the next Prime Minister faces significant economic challenges from higher energy prices, record inflation, to all of the kind of longer term pressures. I mean, we have an ageing population and we're trying to move the economy to net zero. So to break down the differences between the two candidates, we discussed this at length with Ben Zaranko, who's Senior Research Economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies.
I think we know a great deal about what Rishi Sunak's economic policy agenda might look like because he was, of course, Chancellor for the last couple of years. He had lots of chance to set out his stall. And I think we have a fairly good idea of what things might look like, at least over the next few years. Liz Truss has indicated a bit of a more shaking things up, a bit more of a change of direction. She's promising large-scale tax cuts. That's partly just reversing tax rises that have already been announced or that are already in the books. And she's promising to, you know, relook at the Bank of England's mandate. She's talking about changing the government's fiscal rules. She's talking about almost, you know, a much bigger shift in Britain's economic policy. And I think that the key dividing line between the two for me is Rishi Sunak is prioritising safe stewardship of the public finances, prioritising getting inflation down, the public finances in a healthy position before he's willing to think about tax cuts. Liz Truss is willing to do big bang tax cuts right away. If that means higher borrowing, so be it. She also wants to spend more on defence. She said she's not going to be cutting back on spending plans. So it's difficult to see how that could mean anything but a much higher level of borrowing. She hopes that will be paid for by, you know, improved supply side of the economy and improved growth. But I think that's more of a gamble. So I think that's the key split when it comes to economic policy between Sunak and Truss.
Ben, the Tory-led coalition cut corporation tax. Then Rishi Sunak said we needed to increase it to pay the bills from the pandemic. And now Liz Truss is proposing to get rid of those increases to corporation tax. What are the costs of that policy?
So as it stands in legislation, corporation tax is set to go from 19% to 25% over the next few years. Liz Truss wants to scrap that rise. That will come at a cost of about £17 billion per year in the near term. Perhaps less in the medium to long term, as hopefully you'd encourage more business investment and that would generate additional revenues. It's also important to emphasise that the headline rate of corporation tax isn't the only thing that matters. George Osborne cut the headline rate of corporation tax quite significantly, but he also squeezed things like investment allowances. So actually the amount of revenue raised didn't fall very much at all. Sunak has said, yes, I'm going to increase the headline rate, but he's been doing a consultation over the summer before he quit the Treasury into how we might reform investment allowances to better target incentives for businesses to pump money into investment. Liz Truss is signalling instead she wants to focus on the headline rate. So I think both are keen to use a tax system to encourage investment, but have quite different visions about how that ought to be done.
OK, that's for businesses. But then the national insurance rise was so hard fought over within the Conservative Party. And it was passed, a tax both on employers and employees. Now it looks like it's back in question again.
That's right. So it's only recently come into effect. It's about £13 billion a year it raised. So if you want to scrap that, that's about how much it would cost, which taken together with the £17 billion for corporation tax means Liz Truss has promised at least £30 billion of tax cuts. Now, it's important to remember that the national insurance rise was explicitly said this is to help pay for rising costs of health and social care with an elderly population. That social care reform package that was announced as well, the money for that is supposed to come from this tax rise. If Liz Truss wants to scrap that, is she also saying we're going to spend less on health and social care? I don't think that's been made clear. And the key thing in the long term is the levels of tax and spending cannot diverge indefinitely. If you want to have lower taxes, ultimately, in the end, you're going to also have lower spending. And the question for those candidates should be, okay, what do you want to spend less on? Where are those spending cuts going to come from to fund those big tax cuts that you're promising too?
Ben, I appreciate this is a tricky question, but is all this doable? When I say all this, I'm talking about Liz Truss's plans. How much fiscal headroom is there? Is it easy just to have these tax cuts? Can we afford it?
So on the basis of the government's own forecasts in March, the government has two self-imposed fiscal targets. I'll spare you the details, but the headline is they had about £30 billion of what you call headroom. So they're going to meet those targets with about £30 billion to spare. And that's why we've had some candidates say they could afford £30 billion of tax cuts without having to increase borrowing or without putting fiscal rules at risk. Now, that number could change quite substantially. Clearly, a lot has changed since March. The economy is incredibly turbulent this year, and we don't know if that money is still going to be there come the autumn. There's all sorts of downside risks. But Liz Truss has not only promised £30 billion plus of tax cuts, she's also promised to increase defence spending and all sorts of other tax changes and reviews she's thinking about. So I think that if we're being realistic, Liz Truss would have to change those fiscal rules in order to allow her to borrow more. Now, that's reasonable. People can disagree about what the appropriate level of borrowing is, and if she wants to borrow more within a new fiscal framework, that's fine. It should be transparently communicated. And it's a big question is for the long term, really. What does this look like going forwards? Can these tax cuts help to boost the supply side and growth of the economy? If that doesn't work, are we going to have to be looking at tax rises or spending cuts in future? That seems very possible. And I think there's a little bit of a sense of, we'll promise the big tax cuts now and hope that they pay for themselves in the long run. That feels like a bit of a gamble.
I want to ask you about the cost of living, actually. So the government has already spent a lot of money, right, on attempting to alleviate the inflation problem. How much has it spent, roughly, and what more could it spend on? What more are the candidates proposing to spend?
Well, Rishi Sunak, as Chancellor, oversaw a support package, in a bit awkwardly done, a bit done here and a bit done there. But it added up to about £38 billion or so. Of support, and that's fairly well targeted at the bottom end, protecting low earners and low-income households who we think are least able to weather the storm, but with support across the board as well, so like universal money off energy bills, for example. And I'm sure he would say, I've already provided substantial support. It means that low-income households should be at least no worse off on average than they were last year. I don't think either of these candidates have actually proposed anything further on cost of living. Some of the other candidates are proposing cuts to fuel duty and so on, cuts to VAT. I think these two are more focusing on the longer term vision right now, but that may change when they come into Downing Street at the same time as Ofgem increases the energy price cap. There may be pressure for more to be done there, more money for energy bills, more council tax rebates.
I mean, we've got a dozen hustings between now and September. Look, cut through all of this for me, Ben Soranko, then. What sort of Conservative Party member do you think is going to vote for Liz Truss versus Rishi Sunak? What is going to be in their minds economically when they're thinking about choosing between these two candidates? How would you describe them?
There's all sorts of metrics on which people may make these decisions. I think if you're thinking purely about economic policy, I think the key division here is, do you want to be sort of a more cautious approach with careful stewardship of the public finances put first, saying, yes, I would love to deliver tax cuts, but only when we're sure that they're affordable and we can do that without compromising on our ability to bring down government debt? Or do you want to see a big bang of tax cuts straight away, even if that means higher borrowing? Perhaps that's worse for the public finances, with a gamble on what that maybe might mean for growth. I think that's the choice between the two. I think one is perhaps the more known, more often trodden course of action. One is a bit more of a gamble. I think that's the way to frame the choice set facing Conservative members.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive. When bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring, when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Ewan Potts. Well, with the economy centre stage, we've just been speaking to the Institute for Fiscal Studies about the numbers behind Truss and Sunak's campaigns.
Well, when Parliament returns from recess, there'll be an inquiry into whether Boris Johnson lied to the House of Commons. We learnt yesterday that the Prime Minister could face a by-election if the inquiry finds him guilty. Someone who has tracked this phenomenon in politics is journalist, author and broadcaster Peter Oborne. From his 2005 book, The Rise of Political Lying, to his latest work, The Assault on Truth, Boris Johnson, Donald Trump and the Emergence of a New Moral Barbarism. And I'm pleased to say that Peter Oborne is with us here on Bloomberg Radio. Peter, thank you so much for joining us on what is an immensely difficult subject for voters, for politicians. Is lying, though, worse now than it has been before? And if so, why do you think it is?
Oh, it's definitely worse. It is true that the Blair government, and Tony Blair and his sort of entourage in particular, made some terrible lies about the Iraq war. And in particular, of course, although Mr. Blair, I should stress, still maintains it wasn't a lie, he just got it wrong, the weapons of mass destruction idea, which provided the legal justification as far as Britain was concerned for the war. But what we've seen in the last really 5 or 10 years is something new. First of all, Donald Trump, who, as we know, was a sort of systemic liar and couldn't tell the difference between lies and truth, and deployed lies as a political weapon in order to target minorities in particular and gather support. And he's been followed by Boris Johnson, who was a prodigious liar. I mean, he and his cabinet too, I'm afraid, were brought into this. There had been quite a strong ethic of telling the truth in British public life, and Boris Johnson just trashed it.
You make the argument in your book that Johnson and Trump's methodology of deceit is about securing power for its own ends, and even when they get exposed for lying, they shrug it off as a matter of no consequence. Is that partly our fault for letting them get away with that?
Very much. A large part of this story is media complicity in the lying phenomenon. And I tell that I tried to expose Mr. Johnson's lying after he became prime minister, and I just couldn't get it with any interest in the press because the media had become so partisan towards Johnson that they enabled Mr. Johnson to create his own truth in order to win power. And that explains his survival in office for so long, because the mainstream media groups, the Murdoch press, which also significantly owns Fox News, the Associated Press in Britain and the Telegraph Group, they really protected Johnson from and didn't make an issue of his lying.
Mm. What about social media? Is that a factor? I mean, that's certainly something, you know, with Trump that was an issue.
I wonder. Actually, oddly enough, I follow Twitter, and I noticed that Twitter has been very good at exposing Mr. Johnson's lies. You get sort of respected academics like, say, Jonathan Portes or Peter Stefanovic, who's a from the trade union movement, and they've been really assiduous at exposing the falsehoods of senior British politicians, but they never got followed up in the mainstream media, including the BBC, I think, was very negligent at letting Johnson get away with it. So it wasn't simply the written press, which was so partisan for so long towards Johnson, and so it just became too embarrassing at the very end. It was also the mass sort of broadcast media.
But it isn't just the media, is it? There's a section of the electorate in the US with Trump, and in this country with Johnson, and to a certain extent with Corbyn as well on the other side, who just don't care whether what's being said is true or not. Their man is right, and that's the end of it.
Yes, there's a lovely phrase called, which I stole from an American writer or a sociologist, social anthropologist, tribal epistemology. And you take the sort of football analogy when your team is playing another side hacks down your defender. Well, you're convinced that's a foul, but you see everything which your referee does purely through the prism of your own sort of football team, and that is okay when it comes to doing sport. But when you're doing politics, we have had this doctrine actually in Britain, especially, of a neutral public arena where one of the rules of the game is that there are truths, that there is a common agenda a common truth which we all adhere to, and we should have very different interpretations of those truths, but we do accept that there is a common truth which belongs to all sides. What we've happened now, and Trump exploited this, and Johnson just as much, and in a more sophisticated way in some ways, we actually have started to own the truth. Truth has become something which is you take ownership of, as a football team takes ownership of the rules.
But then you also must be, I mean, you are a conservative at heart, you're a Brexiteer. You must be pretty disappointed in the Conservative Party, capital C, and Tory MPs in that case.
I'm amazed by the Tory party and many Tory MPs, including, I should say, both the contenders to replace Mr. Johnson. They were leading figures of Mr. Johnson's cabinet and sit there in PMQs, Prime Minister's Questions, hearing Mr. Johnson lie week after week after week and not worrying about it. They are complicit in this bent system. And that can't be forgotten. The Conservative Party, it's important to say, means conservative in the sense of obeying due process, respecting established institutions, and particularly having a kind of integrity. And of course, what Johnson has done to the Conservative Party is trash all of that. He's trashed truth. He tried to trash Parliament. He's trashed the reputation of the Conservative Party very much as Trump has sort of termed the Republican Party, from being really quite a respectable political organization, into a sort of alt-right group beset with conspiracy theories. Trump has attacked the rule of law. Johnson attacked the rule of law. And always, of course, then taking aim at minority groups. And that Muslims in both cases, actually.
So, I mean, in this kind of pretty depressing landscape, does anything change? How do we fight back, perhaps, if we do agree that there should be a common truth? And how are we in some ways catching up? And again, sort of via social media, towards the end of Trump's time, every TV station and online, people were fact-checking, organisations decided to sort of live fact-check statements. Are we going to get to that point in the UK too? PMQs, there's going to be a little box next to it with somebody sort of giving you the data.
I'm very critical of... There are several excellent fact-checking organisations, the most important of which is Full Fact. Will Moy is the chap who runs it. I really recommend him. I think you should... listen to him. He and they are excellent. The BBC has been negligent. You're quite right. They should have had PMQs. There should have been a little box, because Johnson, towards the end, especially, there was often three or four lies per PMQs. It was incredible. A new kind of political epistemology had emerged. And I don't see, I think, I'm going to write a letter actually to Mr. Sunak and to Ms. Truss and ask them to both cases that we need to have a correction of the parliamentary record for all of the times that, in defiance of the ministerial code, Boris Johnson misled the House of Commons. I've got a list. I have a website, boris-johnson-lies.com, very detailed, has about 700-plus lies or misleading statements, to use the proper term, told by Mr. Johnson and his cabinet colleagues. Now, what I'm going to ask Truss and Sunak to do is to correct the record in all cases. And that would be a huge symbol or signal that they are going to bring honesty back. Sounds a very quaint and old-fashioned idea, but actually political discourse isn't possible without it back into British public life.
Is there at least hope that Trump and Johnson and their particular brand of politics is an aberration? Or do you think really that we are going down a path now and it is something of a sort of one-way street?
Well, I think we have to fight it because ultimately liberal democracy isn't possible without it. Let's take the analogy with the financial markets. You know, that's which is Bloomberg's core territory. If one trader rings another and says, "I'll pay you $5.50 a share," and then later on he denies saying, "I know, I was offering you $5.30," the whole thing collapses. But that is what Johnson does day in, day out, or has done in his wretched, squalid, amoral premiership, and it wouldn't be permitted in financial markets because they would just collapse on the basis, you know, sort of mass of lawsuits. But somehow Johnson has discovered, or that was his methodology, as did Trump, that you can lie repeatedly to voters and it doesn't matter.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.